So tonight's verse is, as I said in my email, one of the longest ones in the book. I think there's only one other this long. I don't know why I even think about things like what's the longest and what's the halfway point. It's just me getting caught up in time, duality, categories, separation. So this is number 38. The master doesn't try to be powerful, thus he is truly powerful. The master doesn't try to be powerful, thus he is truly powerful. The ordinary man keeps reaching for power, thus he never has enough. The ordinary man keeps reaching for power, thus he never has enough. The master does nothing, yet he leaves nothing undone. The master does nothing, yet he leaves nothing undone. The ordinary man is always doing things, yet many more are left to be done. The ordinary man is always doing things, yet many more are left to be done. The kind man does something, yet something remains undone. The just man does something and leaves many things to be done. The moral man does something, and when no one responds, he rolls up his sleeves and uses force. That's a very, very interesting set of couplets. The kind man does something, yet something remains undone. The just man does something and leaves many things to be done. The moral man does something, and when no one responds, he rolls up his sleeves and uses force. When the Tao is lost, there is goodness. When goodness is lost, there is morality. When morality is lost, there is ritual. Ritual is the husk of true faith, the beginning of chaos. It's very, very interesting. When the Tao is lost, there is goodness. When goodness is lost, there is morality. When morality is lost, there is ritual. Ritual is the husk of true faith, the beginning of chaos. Therefore, the master concerns himself with the depths and not the surface. Therefore, the master concerns himself with the depth and not the surface, with the fruit and not the flower. He has no will of his own. He dwells in reality and lets all illusions go. He has no will of his own. He dwells in reality and lets all illusions go. It's quite a lot to swallow, this one. I think the beginning verses are pretty straightforward. The master doesn't try to be powerful, thus he is truly powerful. I think even if we don't embody that, we can get it. We can get that when we're reaching for and striving for, we're never going to get it. It's always going to be just on the other side. What's that saying? The grass is always greener on the other side. Whereas when we simply are, when we simply embody what is, which in this language is power, we're right there. You know, so many of the verses in this Tao Te Ching are basically making the same point from all different perspectives. You know, it's all about opening into that shift, allowing that shift to happen where we simply are. Now, being in this moment, opening into the big isness of the life-death-life cycle. So the master doesn't try to be powerful, thus he is truly powerful. It's all about, it's, you know, the Bhagavad Gita says this in another way, you know, it's all about letting go of the attachment to being anything other than what we are in any given moment. And when we do that, we simply are. And when we simply are, power is flowing through us, because there's no separation, right? It's the striving and the reaching and the grasping and the attachment, all those yoga words that create that sense of separation, that cut us off from the experience of the depth of our own being, that the unfathomable depth of our own being. The master does nothing, yet he leaves nothing undone. That's a kind of fun one, because if you think, I mean, if you're like me, you have to-do lists up the wazoo. To-do lists and more to-do lists and itemized sections of the to-do list and prioritizing and all the stuff that we do to get through the week. And this is a kind of fun, because the master does nothing, yet he leaves nothing undone. It's true, if you do nothing, then you'll leave nothing undone, right? It's kind of like a Zen koan. So if we could have the awareness that when we're doing something, we're actually doing nothing, then it all gets done, right? It's very Zen-like. The master does nothing, yet he leaves nothing undone. I think another way to spin that, another way to understand it again, when we really live with the awareness that doing is happening through us, it's not that we're the doer, you know, that's a big thing in yogic philosophy, you know, you are not the doer. Doing is happening through us. So when we're not the doer, we're not doing anything, we're doing nothing. And when we're doing nothing, we're liberated from the need to do something. Because the need to do something creates stress, to use a very modern word. The ordinary man is always doing things, yet many more are left to be done, because we're never done. I remember many years ago, I'm in my 20s, early, not even, I was younger than 20. I must have been 18 or 19, probably around 19. 18, 19, something like that. Family just moved to New York City. We were living in this great big apartment building. And I had this boyfriend. And we used to take LSD together. So we were tripping on acid once. And we were up on the roof of the building. I'll never forget this. I mean, it's so many years ago. It's 40-something years ago. More. God. Probably 44 years ago. So we're up on the roof. We're tripping out of our minds, and we're just looking down from this very tall roof on the city. And I remember him saying, it was probably like 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, we probably went up to watch the sunrise, but stuff was already happening and construction. And I remember him looking down and saying, boy, they're never gonna finish this city. So true, you know, it's how I feel about my to-do list, you know. It's amazing how just, you know, you wash the dishes and then you realize the floor needs to be swept, and then you sweep the floor and then you remember you had to do the laundry. And then while you're doing the laundry, you notice that something else needs to get put away. And then you remember that you should have switched the summer and the winter clothes already a month ago. And, you know, so it goes. We're never going to get finished. So better to do nothing. And I always find, don't you find it's true that when you just relax about everything, it all happens anyway? It's amazing to me how when I relax about everything, it happens. And it gets done better, in fact. The master does nothing, yet he leaves nothing undone. The ordinary man is always doing things, yet many more are left to be done. Now this next verse I find very interesting. The kind man does something, yet something remains undone. The just man does something and leaves many things to be done. The moral man does something, and when no one responds, he rolls up his sleeves and uses force. It reminds me, this particular verse reminds me very much of the yogic teaching of the three gunas, which some of you probably know, but I'll tell it to you again. You know, in the psychology of yoga, one of the ways that they organize our perceiving faculty is through what they call the three gunas. And the gunas are, if you think of your consciousness as just this pure crystalline, clear insight, there's nothing between it and anything. It's just, it perceives reality exactly as it is. That's pure consciousness. Well, the first guna is called the sattva guna. And when sattva comes down, it's like the veil. It talks about the veils of maya. The gunas are the veils of maya. So when sattva guna comes down, it's a very nice guna. It's almost clear. You can imagine it. It's also a very clear veil, but maybe it's got just the slightest tint, maybe like a little pink tint, but it is a tint. So it is diffusing the way we perceive so-called reality. It's very pure though. If you think of, like, just think of yourself on just a beautiful, it's a glorious fall day. It's just like a perfect day. The sky is blue, the air is clear. There's that shimmering, just everything is shimmering. That's kind of sattva guna. It's just lovely, but it's still a guna. And I think this very much, the kind man, you know, kindness is a sattvic quality. The kind man does something, yet something remains undone, because even though the sattva guna, it's fabulous, it's not absolutely clear reality with a capital R. And so I think that kind man, who's operating very much infused with the energy of a sattva guna, there's still something. See, there's still that hint of separation. Nothing has become something. Maybe only a teensy weensy weensy bit of something, but it's something. And once it's something, it's not nothing anymore, right? The just man does something and leaves many things to be done. So he reminds me of Rajas Guna. The Rajas Guna, when you're stressed, when your mind is very active, when you're just in a very intense, that's Raja Guna. It's not so bad. Sometimes it's kind of good to be in a rajasic. So if you need to get a lot done, if your to-do list is really long, maybe, if you want to get it done really fast, maybe not perfectly, and maybe stressing yourself out a lot, but it will get done, that's Rajas Guna is operating through you. So, and the just man, you know, just, a just person is very rajasic. Rajasic is very, very intellectual. The just man does something but leaves many things undone. Because you know how it is. When you're under the influence of the Rajas Guna, you do a lot. BlackBerry in one hand, iPhone in the other, texting while you're driving, you know, multitasking on steroids. It's the Rajas Guna. The moral man does something, and when no one responds, he rolls up his sleeves and uses force. And this, of course, reminds me of what is called tattva guna. Tamas guna. Now, the tamas guna gets a bad rap because it's just like, and it's true. A tamasic state is when you're just like in sludge. You just can't. You're so tired. Your mind is in such a dull state. You're just like a big blob. That's tamas guna. And, it, you know, it gets a bad rap because we're a very rajasic culture. So anybody who's just like blob-like, you know, we're very critical of blob consciousness. And that's tamas guna. But it's also actually absolute stillness. You know, I think each of the gunas, like everything, has a shadow and then another sublime presence. But we'll focus on the blob part of tamas guna. So the kind of morality that this verse is pointing to, it is a very tamasic way because it's really stuck in itself. You know, anyone who's really stuck in a very rigid belief system, that's very tamasic. Stuckness, rigidity, and the kind of morality that the Tao Te Ching is poking fun at is very much a tamasic kind of morality. It's like a, you know, like any kind of religious fundamentalist, any fundamentalist, any closed system. Because when it's in a rajasic system, it may be rajasic, but it's moving. But in a tamasic system, everything is just stuck. It's sludge. It's mud. It's blah. And so the moral man does something, and when no one responds, he rolls up his sleeve and uses force. You know, it's like, it's bad enough that nothing has become something. Now we're actually using force to move it. So now there's no escape. You know, now we're so imprisoned or caught or trapped in this doing, 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 that it's even now it has to be forced. And you know what they say, if you have to force it, you probably shouldn't be doing it in the first place, right? If we're working too hard. I had a colleague many years ago, a very, very gifted psychoanalyst, and we were talking about couples therapy once, and we were talking about some couples are always working on their relationship. And he said, yeah, you know, when you're always working on your relationship, it's not really working. And it's true. It's like when we're always working on something, whatever it is, it's not really working. There's no ease. That's not the master who does nothing and leaves nothing undone. It's just the opposite. When the Tao is lost, there is goodness. Again, the Tao would be that pure crystalline, guna-free awareness. And out of that, everything new, the universe simply flows, however it flows. When the Tao is lost, which, I mean, it's a linguistic thing, obviously the Tao is never lost, but when we lose touch with the Tao, the first thing that arises is the need for goodness. Right? If we're not all living a Tao-infused life, we have to begin inventing rules, right, for how to all live together. So rule number one, be good. Isn't the golden rule, really. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. But we don't really even need to bring goodness into the equation if we're simply Tao conscious. Because then we are good. When goodness is lost, morality, again, the Tao Te Ching is really very anti what we would consider organized religion and codes of ethics and morality. Because from the perspective of this text, these ways of thinking arise as we lose more and more touch with our primal source of being. When goodness is lost, there is morality. It's okay. I mean, it's getting a little dry, but it's, you know, we're still hanging in there. But now when morality is lost, there is ritual. And again, this isn't talking about a lovely ritual that we might enjoy because it infuses us with luminosity. This, again, is talking about a ritual that hardens, a ritual that hardens into dogma, a ritual that hardens into a closed system of this is how it is, and this is the only way it is, and if you don't do this ritual, you will, bad things will happen. And again, that's necessary when we don't even have a natural morality bubbling up from inside of us. We need to impose tighter and tighter and tighter restrictions, or we'll all, you know, be acting out all over the place. So goes that the mindset that creates these things. Ritual is the husk of true faith. That one, I had to really sit with that for a while, but if you think about a husk, it's a hard shell that contains something, right? So if ritual is the husk of true faith, then true faith is not something that we would necessarily think of as desirable. And I mean desirable not in the desire clinging, but something that we would want to cultivate. Again, here, true faith, it's talking about a relative way of thinking, you know, that there is a truth. There is only one truth. And the faith has to, is of that truth. So we're in a very, very, very rigid system now. Right? The true faith. I'm sure we've heard fundamentalist religious kind of people use that phrase, the true faith. But there just happened to be quite a few other chufes. And so that's a very, very rigid husk, and ritual becomes the husk of that very closed, very fear-based, clinging to a certain notion of what is right and what is wrong. So ritual becomes the husk of that, and that truly is the beginning of chaos, because maybe in this one little teeny tiny place, there seems to be at least the illusion of order, but everything outside of that is a fearsome abyss of chaos, right? It's a very, very, very complex verse. Therefore, the master concerns himself with the depths and not the surface, because all this other stuff, goodness, morality, ritual, true faith, these are all really on the surface. They're all the different emanations or forms that rise up out of the chaos of being. But when we're just down there, at one with the chaos, it's not chaos anymore. The something goes back to its original nothing, and we simply are. Yeah? Everything is one down there, underground. It's all the same. Therefore, the master concerns himself with the depths and not the surface, with the fruit and not the flower. It's so funny, this is so obvious, but I actually had to sit with it almost the whole week. I kept thinking, well, why fruit and not flower? I mean, I love flowers. What's wrong with flowers? But then, of course, I realized it's the flower that becomes a fruit. It's not the flower. That's the final offering of the flower. It's, you know, like the orange blossom or the squash blossom. The cherry blossom becomes something much more complex. He has no will of his own. He dwells in reality and lets all illusions go. He has no will of his own. He dwells in reality and lets all illusions go. It's you know, this is the state of mastery. This is why we do yoga. This is why we practice any wisdom tradition. Because something in us is reaching for itself. You know, something in us is reaching for that reality with a capital R. You know, something in us is reaching into the light that it knows is what it is, you know? Therefore, the master concerns himself with the depths and not the surface, with the fruit and not the flower. He has no will of his own. He dwells in reality and lets all illusions go. So it's hard to come up with parallel readings to go along with this one, but I found a couple. So here is how morality and ritual and truth happen. This is an old Christian story. When the Son of God was nailed to the cross and died, he went straight down to hell from the cross and set free all the sinners who were there in torment. And the devil wept and mourned, for he thought he would get no more sinners. And God said to him, "Do not weep, for I shall send you all those who are self-righteous in their condemnation of sinners, and hell shall be filled up once more until I return." Yeah. And then the other, I had a great experience actually of the master doing nothing. I knew exactly the story I wanted, and I couldn't find it. And I was just, you know, I was going through the book, and I was like, went through every single page, and I was annoyed because there's no index, and I was annoyed because the table of contents is very, very sparse. And this is a big book, and I'm looking at every page, and I can't find it, and I can't remember, is it the beginning, is it in the middle, where is it? And then, my hand, I was actually holding it. My finger was right there on the page. I had no idea. This is an example of the master doing nothing and not even realizing. Because the master is so obliterated by the ordinary one. This is what we do, right? This is how we live our lives. So, this is a fun story. The rich, this is just a contemporary wisdom story, no tradition is cited. The rich industrialist from the north was horrified to find the southern fisherman lying lazily beside his boat smoking a pipe. "Why aren't you out fishing?" said the industrialist. "Because I have caught enough fish for the day," said the fisherman. "Why don't you catch some more?" "What would I do with it?" "You could earn more money," was the reply. "With that, you can have a motor fixed to your boat to go into deeper water and catch more fish. Then you would make enough money to buy nylon nets. These would bring you more fish and more money. Soon you would have enough money to own 2 boats, maybe even a fleet of boats. Then you would be a rich man like me." "What would I do then?" "Then you could really enjoy life." "What do you think I am doing right now?" So clearly we can tell who's all caught up in the Rajas Guna and who's hanging back. Maybe in the Tao, maybe a little sattva, but I think pretty much in that clear seeing way. So we want to cultivate that awareness. And that's why we're here. So you did great on the Trayambakam, and you know, even that was interesting. I usually don't make a conscious decision about what chant we're going to do. I'll start about an hour or two before class starts. I start hearing a chant, and I always figure that's the one for tonight. But what I was hearing tonight wasn't sitting right inside of me. And it just wasn't sitting right inside of me. And then about 5 minutes before I was ready to just sort of pack up and leave, I got this Trayambakam. You must do the Trayambakam tonight. So I'm great, okay, fine. And then the phone rings, it's Danny, saying he can't come to class tonight. Which is kind of amazing because we don't really need drumming for the Trayambakam. It's fine with or without. I mean, it's great with the cymbal, but it's not necessary. So that was another one of those little moments of reality moving through me. We'll chant Om Namah Shivaya now, but we'll do Trayambakam again at the end. And I want to just say to you that it's very beautiful. You're chanting, and as you got more and more comfortable with it, the unison got stronger and stronger and stronger. And the unison in any mantric chant is a very, very powerful statement in and of itself. It has a way, you know, we know the mantras are shaping us on the inside. When the group is chanting in perfect unison as you are doing, the atmosphere in the room is literally, it's like a knife is just shaping the room, you know, cutting away any energy in the room that's not of what we're calling the Tao, and infusing the entire space with a very scintillating energy. And for those of you who don't know, Trayambakam is a really great mantra. It's considered a mantra that bestows immortality. But again, you want to have the right understanding, which is another reason I think it was the one that wanted to be chanted tonight, paired up with this reading. Because what is immortality really but not being stuck in a sense of limitation, right? What is immortality really but not being caught in a notion? What is immortality really but not being caught in that doing? It's like immortality is nothing as opposed to something, right? It's very open, it's very spacious, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It's no boundary. Immortality is infinity consciousness. And so you want to understand that that's what Trayambakam is cultivating inside of us. And the more focus you bring to each syllable in the mantra, the more you'll feel this interesting thing happening inside of you. It's a very, how can I say, it's very clarifying and strengthening and solidifying of truth, but not the truth they're joking about in Tao Te Ching. This is truth with capital T truth. This is reality with a capital R truth. So we'll chant Om Namah Shivaya now, as we always do, and then we'll have some silent sitting time, and then we'll end tonight with, again, Triambakan.